to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. I'm Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zampro, naturopathic physician, and your host for this show where we talk about issues in health, wellness, and alternative medicine today. Dr. Kamai has the week off, and you can always get more information about our workshops, fun shops, things that we're doing at her website, which is naturalnurse.com. So we have an interesting guest today. We have Dr. Florence McPherson, and she is a naturopathic physician and has her doctorate in naturopathic medicine. She's a naturopathic physician in the state of Connecticut, but she specializes in homeopathy and has postdoctoral training in that particular niche of natural medicine. She's an adjunct clinical and didactic professor of homeopathy at the College of Naturopathic Medicine at the University of Bridgeport in Connecticut, which was the school that I helped found back in the late 90s. Dr. McPherson teaches introductory homeopathy courses at the university, which she helped design and create for the first and second year naturopathic physicians, and she also supervises advanced students at the university's health clinic. Now, she started practicing homeopathy over 20 years ago when she lived in Seattle, Washington, and then she began to cultivate and hone her herbal knowledge and naturopathic knowledge, and that spurned her to go eventually to the East Coast and enter naturopathic school. She's been practicing now for about 13 years, and she continues this work. I'm here with Dr. McPherson to talk about homeopathy, and I can't wait to talk to her. She's also, by the way, a member of the American Institute of Homeopathy, New York Academy of Sciences, and American Association of Naturopathic Physicians. And she recently was honored to study with Professor George Vithoukas at the International Academy of Classical Homeopathy in Alonissos, Greece. And previously she studied with Russell Malcolm, who has many accolades, but he was the former consultant to the Royal London Homeopathic Hospital in London, England. She's loves the outdoors, and she has a great daughter, and I can't wait to have her on. Flo, how are you?
Hi, Dr. Z. Always a pleasure.
Oh, yeah, it's great to have you on. So, wow, there's a lot to talk about here. Homeopathy is a huge, huge topic. You know, I just wanted to say that I was just listening to NPR yesterday, and there was this guy disparaging homeopathy. I felt really like I wanted to call and complain, but I figured we would do justice on our radio show here and talk about the science behind homeopathy. What is homeopathy? I know that's a kind of a loaded question because you could talk for hours on that, and you do. You talk for 19 weeks on it.
Yes. Homeopathy is a system of medicine that was established in the late 1700s by Samuel Hahnemann, and it's based on the theory that like treats like. And with homeopathy and any alternative medicine, we believe that the body has an inherent ability to heal if we just give it the slight impetus to do so. And so homeopathy works not on contrara contraris, which is the theory of most general popular medicine. Allopathic or pharmaceutical prescriptions are based on contrara contraris, like working to kill things in the body or against the body to have health recovery. But homeopathy and natural medicine works with the body. And there was a great example that somebody, it was actually Ellen Kamai, when she interviewed me on her show. She said, well, what happens to a person when you slice an onion? When you slice an onion, your eyes tear. So if a person has that symptom, what we would do is we would take that exact substance that brought the symptom on and make it into a homeopathic preparation through a series of dilutions and shaking succussions to release nanoparticles and give a slight dose to the individual, and like treating like, the tearing goes away.
Yeah, that is interesting.
Yeah.
Now, when like cures like could also mean that similar things cure similar things too, right?
Yes.
So let's say we have coffee, for an example. Most people know about coffee. Maybe some drink coffee. And in a high dose, like having an espresso or going to your favorite coffee shop, that has a very stimulating effect on the body's force, on the physiology of the body. But
yes,
if you were to use homeopathic coffee, it actually it'll put you to sleep.
Yes.
So it's amazing that it actually, at the homeopathic level, it has the opposite effect of the higher material dose. So that's a law of medicines, right? That the same substance,
yes,
can have different effects.
Yes, and that is what the research is being done currently. There's a lot of research being done on homeopathy. Alice Bell at the University of Arizona is doing a lot of studies using small dilutions, which is many of our homeopathic pharmacopoeia. It's all dilutions. She's using it on actual cells and seeing reactions at a cellular level in a positive direction. So coffea, the remedy coffea, is indicated for somebody who's having insomnia with racing thoughts, similar to that effect that you feel when you've had too much coffee.
Right. So it will only treat that type of insomnia. If you have insomnia because you're in, for a different reason, like you've lost a loved one or something like that, that isn't the precise prescription of homeopathy. Tell us how you actually go about the process of meeting the patient and choosing the remedy, and then we'll talk more about, the physics of homeopathy as we unfold the conversation.
Okay, yes, so it's very true. Homeopathic medicines or remedies have to be specifically prescribed to the individual. So the interview process can be quite lengthy sometimes, because what we're trying to get from the interview process is the specific imbalance of the individual's pattern, their disease patterns or their symptoms. So we have to match that precisely with the homeopathic remedy that can treat that symptom, and then insert a small dose into the person sublingually so that their vital reaction can respond to the introduction of the remedy. And that's how people cure in homeopathy. So when the patient first comes, we sit and we talk about their life, we talk about their symptoms, we talk about their symptomatic history, their family history. It's a comprehensive interview, because what we're looking for is called the totality of symptoms, which is a very different concept from other medicines. If you go into the office with a swollen knee, let's say, in a traditional allopathic medicine, they're just going to treat the knee. What a homeopath is going to try to look for is to treat the person with the knee that is swollen, which takes more time to figure out what the totality is, or where this person's vital force began to become weak and therefore show symptoms.
So they may have been angry before their knee pain or something like that, or there might have been some emotional things that are chronically going on, or an emotional archetype or a behavioral archetype that the patient demonstrates that would separate that particular patient with knee pain from someone else walking in the door with knee pain, you're saying?
Yes, or they have a different etiology of the knee pain. It could be emotional. It could be maybe they have encountered a bacteria or a spirochete like Lyme in the past that they never fully recovered from. So the body is continuing to try to make the attempt to heal itself, but it can't do it. It needs a stronger impetus or the remedy inserted into the vital force for that vital force to strengthen to cure.
You mentioned vital force a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Let's define that for people.
Well, I've spent some time thinking about this, too, in comparing what I do as a naturopath and a homeopath to what a medical doctor prescribing pharmaceuticals might do. In the two, where I think we differ the most is, as a naturopath and a homeopath, we believe it's part of our precepts and our concept that we believe that the body, given the right materials, can heal itself, and all healing that is done is really done by the individual given a correct plan. So when we look at the physical body, we say, what animates this physical body other than the basic operations of physiology, you know, the heartbeat, the endocrine system, the blood flow? This is all physical, but there is something else. What do we see when we look at a being, even an animal or a human being that has passed on? It's a physical body that has no life. So in homeopathy or natural medicine, we say there's something that animates the physical body, and that's what we call the vital force.
Okay. And so we need to kind of harness the vital force by, and how does homeopathy harness that vital force? I guess that's the million-dollar question, maybe
yes.
Billion-dollar.
Well, and Samuel Hahnemann has said this in his Organon of the Medical Art, which is the book on homeopathy. It's up to 6 editions, which he started writing at a very young age, up until the end of his life in his 80s. The remedy works by action and counteraction. So the action is when it is put into the body, which a lot of times and most times is sublingual. So this vital force I'm talking about, or what animates the physical or the whole body, marks a counteraction to the insertion of the remedy into the body, and that is how homeopathy heals. And what they're finding is homeopathy is really the medicine of nanoparticles, which are small particles that exist and could be most similar, which is why homeopathy does work, to what is representative of the vital force in all living beings. Mm. So it could get very heavy.
Yeah. You mentioned Hahnemann. Mm-hmm. How he discovered homeopathy in the 1700s was very fascinating historical story, and then how he built his medicine, his repertory of medicines, and then trained other doctors, and was, of course, you know, castigated, but then embraced by many people. And then homeopathy had lots of historical proof in curing many, many different very severe outbreaks of plagues and other public health hazards like cholera. This is a historical fact. Tell us a little bit about Hahnemann and his writings and how he stumbled upon this very interesting medicine.
So Hahnemann was just a very brilliant person that only comes along ever so often. So it was around 1779, he was translating medical texts of Cullen. And he was noticing that the toxicology of many herbal substances also was similar to diseases and disease symptoms. So they were using Peruvian bark, or Cinchona officinalis, to treat malaria. They were extracting quinine. Mm-hmm. So he noticed that the toxicology of Peruvian bark was very similar to the symptoms of malaria. So he ingested highly toxic amounts of Peruvian bark and began to have the symptoms similar to malaria. So he said, I wonder if I change the character and the potency of this substance by diluting it, by extracting and diluting, and I take it, if I can cure myself of these symptoms that were brought on, and that is what he did. So he began to take drops that were very diluted of the same substance that caused him to have a toxic reaction, the Peruvian bark, and what he found was he was relieved of those toxic symptoms. So it was homeopathically used Peruvian bark to treat malaria. And so this is how he built his homeopathic pharmacopoeia. He began to do studies or provings where he would give people his homeopathic substances and have them write what had happened to them in a 2 or 3 to 4 week period. He collected all the information, repeated 2 times, compiled and tabulated, and that makes the repertory, which is all symptoms that you're looking, you can look to find which correct remedy applies to this individual suffering.
So he basically experimented on people, which is kind of interesting. That's why it's, I find it's the most accurate of medicine as, yeah, I mean, allopathic medicine goes through clinical trials where it's, you know, first animals, first in vitro, then animals, then eventually humans. But he gave these medicines to humans and basically wrote down exactly what happened on many, many levels. Like he looked at how the medicines affected the mental aspects of people, the physical symptoms, and basically head to toe.
Yes, and that's how the repertory is compiled. And he gave it to, he did the provings or experiments. Now, when we talk about these, this is science. A lot of people like to say, well, it's not science, but it is science because he, in fact, had his hypothesis. He did the experiments by giving people his medicines, and then he compiled and tabulated his results. And he didn't just take the first round. He took second and third provings on the same group of individuals. And he had to interview these individuals to make sure that they weren't suffering from any physical diseases or that they were not on other treatments or medications.
You know, like so how do you separate if someone says, well, you know, when I took this medicine, I got a headache, and maybe they were a person who had headaches all the time, so I could see what you're saying. So he thought about that ahead of time.
Yes, he did, and that's why he completed, he used healthy individuals, as healthy as he can find them, through an interview process, and then he repeated the same experiment or proving with this one substance 3 times.
Well, also, he was trying to get Go ahead, Flo, sorry.
At the University of Leipzig, where he taught, he had a provers union. So there were his students and other medical doctors, because Hahnemann, these were all medical doctors, who established a union where they would do a lot of the provings and then invite other students and people from the public to join in the provings or the experiments.
Okay, so he was working with, so these were trained medical people. I don't think people realize that, and particularly people that scoff at homeopathy, is these weren't, kind of way out people. These were medical doctors, highly trained medical doctors at the time that were embracing homeopathy as an alternative. A lot of times it was an alternative to what back then?
Right. It was alternative to bloodletting or mercury treatments. At that time, we're looking at no antibiotics, no vaccinations. This was gross pathology. And yes, one of the people in the Provers Union who was a student of Hahnemann was Constantine Herring, who came to the United States and established the first medical association in the United States, the American Institute of Homeopathy. And a lot of people don't realize that these medical doctors who are still practicing today through, history and studying, a lot of medical doctors practice homeopathy. And so when we look at the organization of the American Institute of Homeopathy, which is established in 1844, it's a stone's throw from Hahnemann because it was one of his students and members of the Provers Union, Constantine Herring, who was also a medical doctor, that established this American Institute of Homeopathy in America back then.
Yeah, and I think the AMA was established in direct opposition at the time, and they were losing lots of money from people who would have cholera and get severe outbreaks of malaria and yellow fever, and the homeopaths were publishing their data in the newspapers. In other words, how many people had died, and the allopaths were publishing how many people who had died under allopathic care, and it was like a dramatic difference between the two. So doctors kind of started to flock towards studying this very interesting medicine, which was getting people better.
Yes, and still does, all these years later.
Now, homeopathy works on plants, and it works on animals, and so there really can't be a placebo effect with plants or animals. I mean, maybe a slight one, if, you know, someone would argue, you know, plants could have a placebo effect, but it would be a very different one than humans, which is, I guess, one of the biggest critiques of homeopathy, that it's all... You must be a pretty good placebo effect person, Dr. McPherson, because I know
exactly.
You've helped lots of patients. You must be a magician.
Exactly.
Getting everyone better with placebo effects. You know what I'm saying? So if you think about it, it's kind of a ridiculous concept, because there's... I mean, the Queen's doctor is... Now, you actually studied with someone that was in line with the Queen of England, the royal family. Tell us about that.
Russell Malcolm. I had learned the use of balneosodes through Russell Malcolm. And balneosodes is another form of homeopathy that can treat dysbiosis in the intestines or in the biofilm of people. But, you know, I just want to go back to placebo, because placebo is very interesting. Mm-hmm. Who's not to say that an allopathic pharmaceutical prescription is not placebo in some instances? Yes, a lot of pharmaceutical drugs have been put through randomized double-blind studies. Homeopathy is catching up, like I mentioned before. Alice Bell is doing cellular studies, seeing changes that are happening at the cellular level when homeopathic medicines are being put into cells and seeing the transformation. This is not placebo. This is experimentation in the lab. But anything could be placebo potentially in medicine. Any type of practice of medicine, could it not? People go to the doctor because they want to feel better, right? And if they have a good experience, regardless of what was given, it could be placebo. So any medicine could be placebo.
Sure, sure. I mean, even though they've done the studies, the fact that you're going to the doctor and getting something and taking it, there's going to be somewhat of a response to those types of things, that's for sure. So what's interesting with homeopathy, how they're actually made. This is a fascinating thing. But before we talk about that, I wanted to talk about, like, use another example of homeopathy classification. And when I teach, because I introduce the first-year students to homeopathy and history of medicine, I get a chance to do that before you see them, Dr. McPherson, at the university. I always talk about the flu, and I do a kind of a fun charades type of thing where I act out the different flu remedies. So here's my point. To an allopathic physician, the flu is the flu is the flu. You have, you know, maybe a particular strain that comes around one year versus another, and there's vaccines and whatnot for them. But people have a very unique way of having their symptoms for that particular flu. Some people will be lethargic and dreary and dopey and dull and drowsy and can't get off the couch and can't even lift their arm up to get a thing of water. Maybe they're sweating or not sweating. Maybe they're achy or not achy. Maybe they have a high fever or a low fever. That same strain of bug, right, interacting with another patient, that patient will have a high fever, red face, enlarged pupils, dry mouth, very agitated. So you have the same bug, very different experience by the patient. Now, the allopath would treat those two patients the same. The homeopath would treat those two flu patients very differently. Go over that.
Yes, because we're not treating the flu bug per se. We're treating the bug and how it has affected the individual, which is what we look for in the interview, meaning the totality of symptoms. Yes, we do have to know our bacterias, our viruses. We have to know how pathogens behave, and we are trained that way as naturopaths and homeopaths. But that's where we differ. We have to say, okay, how is this pathogen? We know the behavior of this pathogen as we know it to this day. Pathogens are constantly transforming, but then we see how it's affected the individual, and that's what we see, the totality of symptoms, and that's what we prescribe to, how the individual has been changed through the pathogen.
So one patient will need belladonna for the flu.
Yes.
And one patient will need gelsemium for the flu. It's interesting that in homeopathy, they seem to categorize diseases not by the microbes that are involved in the disease. Notice I didn't use the word cause, because there's a big difference between that. But involved in somewhere in the line of that. But homeopathy is organized by the medicines that help the individual. So they look at symptoms very differently. How does the homeopathic physician look at symptoms different from an allopathic doctor?
Well, we're looking at how the individual has responded or deals with the symptom, the character of the symptom, which they're looking at too. What makes the person's symptom better? What makes the person's symptom worse? What makes the person themselves feel better? What do they do that makes them feel better, that makes that swollen knee better? Or what is it that they're doing in their life? They say, I feel my knee feels better maybe when I'm walking slowly. Or other people might say, my knee is better when I do some rigorous exercise and I really work those muscles, then I feel better. Some people might say a cold compress makes that knee swelling go down. Other people might say a hot compress makes the knee go down, and so on and so forth through every symptom and every issue that comes up in the interview when we're looking for the totality. Then the totality and all these symptoms relate because they go back to Hahnemann's experiments or provings. When he gave the substance to healthy people, the substance brought on these symptoms, which has been tabulated. So then we go look at this, what makes this knee better, what makes it worse, what makes the patient better, the compress, and we compile this and come up with the one substance that's most suitable for the presentation of the illness.
So basically Hahnemann was creating like artificial flus when he gave people belladonna, for instance. And then he said, then this artificial flu from this remedy would erase or cancel out in some way the real flu that seemed to match those particular way that the body was manifesting it.
Yes.
Interesting, yeah. So that's where like cures like come, folks. So, you know, I'm looking at the time. It's time to take a quick break, get a cup of tea or drink some water, and we'll play one of our natural medicine chests. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the dosing of homeopathy, how they're made, are they safe, some of the controversy, and then, of course, some of Dr. McPherson's research and maybe some cases. So stay with us right here at The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the nutrient known as taurine.
Amino acids are chemical constituents that form the building blocks of protein in the body. The official definition of an amino acid is a compound which contains an amino group and a carboxylic acid. Taurine contains a sulfonic group instead, so is not a true amino acid, although it is often referred to as one. The intracellular concentration of taurine is 10 times that of any normal free amino acid.
Taurine was discovered in 1827, but the significance of taurine in nutrition was not realized until 1975, when the journal Science published a study showing that taurine-deficient cats suffered from retinal degeneration. In 1986, the Annual Review of Biochemistry reported that the amount of taurine present in mammalian milk depends on the species. Natural human mother's milk is rich in taurine, but cow's milk, except for the early milk known as colostrum, is taurine deficient. Pediatrics Journal in 1983 printed a study which outlined several of the biologically significant functions of taurine, and an effort was then made to fortify infant formula by adding taurine.
Some species of animals, such as cats, cannot synthesize taurine within their bodies, and so must receive it through their diets. Humans have a very limited ability to synthesize taurine, so adequate intake through diet and supplementation is important. The principal source of dietary taurine is meat of various types and shellfish. Even people ingesting sufficiently high levels of taurine may develop a deficiency due to the overgrowth of certain anaerobic intestinal microorganisms which consume taurine. Certain prescription drugs are known inhibitors of taurine uptake.
The Journal of Neurochemistry published a study in 1975 which showed that taurine concentrations are extremely high in the retina. In fact, the retina contains two binding proteins specific for taurine. Research has yet to determine exactly how taurine functions in the eye, but deficiency of taurine has been found to lead to the degeneration of photoreceptor cells. Continued studies on taurine have linked its presence to several biological functions, besides being a protector of the delicate tissues of the eye. Taurine helps to neutralize oxidizing agents caused by ionizing radiation. Taurine is present in high concentrations in the normal heart. It stimulates white blood cell motility and protects cell membranes from free radical damage. Taurine has proven useful in epileptics to reduce or control seizures. It helps modulate the transport of substances such as sodium, potassium, magnesium, copper, and iron across cell membranes. Additional research supports taurine's role in preventing gallstones.
So, as you can see, the nutrient taurine may be an important addition to your natural medicine chest.
We're back with more of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and I'm Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zampro, naturopathic physician, herbalist. And we're here with Dr. Florence McPherson, who is an incredible person, by the way, besides a homeopath, naturopathic physician. And we love chatting with her about homeopathy, and just a gifted healer who's helped so many people with this discipline. So we're glad that she's teaching us about homeopathy. And it's important that folks know about this because what's going on with the FDA policies now, Dr. McPherson? Let's talk a little politics, as Peter Tosh used to say, politics.
yes. The way I'm understanding it is the FDA wants to, and the homeopathic pharmacopoeia of the United States, you know, because
what's that, by the way?
Homeopathic medicines are listed as drugs to treat illness. They're not listed as
herbs or supplements or foods.
Right.
Like vitamins and herbs are foods, but homeopathy is actually medicine. It's actually listed as medicine, according to the government. Yeah.
So this is what a lot of the root of the issue is about. And the homeopathic pharmacopoeia of the U.S. just wants to make sure that companies that are saying they are making homeopathic remedies, that they're actually preparing them in accordance with, you know, the way homeopathy is supposed to be prepared, medicines. And personally, you know, the medicine has been around for about 240 years now, and there's still many homeopaths practicing. And I just, no matter what ends up happening at the level of the FDA, it doesn't worry me. There's always a, there's so many people who approach me that want to learn homeopathy, not just naturopathic, or medical students, but lay people, who are just so fascinated with their own experience, what has happened with a remedy where they've gone everywhere else to be. And they took a homeopathic remedy and got better.
You know, let's talk about that. And so it could be used for, like, first aid ailments, but then, you know, for many different serious ailments, you need to go to a professional, kind of tease that out for us, the difference between when it would be a first aid type of thing and when people would need to consult with you or another practitioner, wherever they're listening from.
If, let's say, you encounter a bee sting, then you could go into your homeopathic kit. You could take Ledum. You could take Apis. You could take Urtica, depending on your symptoms. In the first aid, it's a quicker analysis of symptoms and what you would need. But let's say you take the bee sting and you have the bee sting and you take your well executed remedy from your first aid kit and you're still not recovering, then that's the time to consult the homeopath. So typical things that may happen: if you fall, you have a bruise, maybe a bee sting or a puncture wound, these things you can initially treat first aid. Other chronic conditions, rheumatoid arthritis, vaginitis, autoimmune type diseases, heart diseases, all these things you would probably want to consult with a professional homeopath to do a more in-depth case taking.
Okay. Now, a lot of people are on medication. Can homeopathy be used with people on medications? I know the answer is yes, but tell us how you work with that, and I think it has to do with the dosing and the strength of the medicines that you use. And how do you pick a strength of a medicine, by the way?
That's the million-dollar question, which is the art of homeopathy, the organon of the medical art, which is the book by Samuel Hahnemann that every homeopath must study if you want to practice.
Right.
And that's the art, because the remedies are prepared diluted. You can dilute, the amount of dilution is never ending. And when we look at the uniqueness of individuals in the world, each one of us is so unique in our own way, which is the beauty of the dilutions. You can really treat precisely this individual in front of you by really altering your dilution, which takes practice and it takes study to really understand how that works.
Yeah, so it's the way that I discuss it, because dilutions may throw people off, because they think, when I hear dilution, my immediate reflex being, you know, we all think in Newtonian physics, is dilution means weaker. But there's a shaking process in between the dilutions when the medicine's made, and actually dilutions mean stronger, more deeper acting remedies in homeopathy. That seems to fly in the face of Newtonian physics, but it really does figure in well if you're more of an Einsteinian person, you know what I'm saying? Like, and this is where I think a lot of doctors and researchers and allopathic thinking folks get caught up. in understanding the difference between Newtonian physics and biophysics, Einsteinian physics. And you mentioned nanoparticles and other type of energetics. What's going on with the remedies at the higher potencies?
Well, at the higher potencies, by dilution and shaking succussion, more molecular action is happening, and particles are dispersing and being brought out. So that's why they in our modern physics, the quantum physics, which is our scientific basis right now, is saying homeopathy is really nanoparticles. It's nanoparticle medicine. And there are groups of scientists getting together that are studying high dilutions. It's becoming a part of a lot of modern medicine and modern treatment. Luc Montagnier, who won the Nobel Prize for finding what AIDS was, or the HIV virus, had used this concept of homeopathy, of dilution and nanoparticles, to come up with his theory. And later, he has become a proponent of homeopathy. And if you really read his research and the material he puts out, he gives credit to homeopathy. And this is happening more and more with really serious scientists who are saying, you know, there's something to this nanoparticle medicine.
Homeopathy is different from vaccines, right? Because you're using the same thing to stimulate the immune system. So vaccination has some principles of homeopathy, but it's not exactly the same. I think that's important to point out.
Yes, it's not exactly the same because you are injecting... The vaccines are diluted virus, diluted substance that you're injecting into the body.
Sometimes dead, right?
What you want there is you want to inject this material and you want the immune system to respond, because the immune system is constantly responding to anything it encounters. So this is creating an antibody response. But with homeopathy, we're not going to give the person something that they don't currently show a symptom for.
I see.
So in homeopathy, we're going to wait for the virus to happen. Then we're going to treat it rather than preventatively use it. Although there are people who do homeoprophylaxis, which is a whole other subject.
Now, one of my most fascinating studies that I looked at once was there was a study in the UK where they took cows that were suffering from mastitis in their udders. I guess they were over-milked and maybe, you know, whatever, and they developed infections in their udders. And so they divided the group into two groups. One, bunch of cows, and this was done, I think, on 600 cows, got antibiotics, and the other got one tube, this is interesting, one tube of homeopathic pellets put into a 1,000-gallon trough of water. The cows drank the water. The other group got the antibiotics. Do you know that they both recovered equally as well from the mastitis as the antibiotic group? And they gave by the way, they gave the remedy called Phytolacca, which is from the poke root, for that. I found that was fascinating. First of all, it proves that there's no placebo effect unless they petted the cows that got the homeopathics and treated them nicer.
Mm-hmm.
nice cow, and they smacked the other cows. And it also shows the dilution principle.
Yes.
That dilution principle, even if the remedy is diluted, still is enough to energetically give the push to the cows. Vital force, their innate intelligence to thwart the disease. So I found that was one of my most fascinating research trials. And when they do homeopathy on infants, plants, animals, you know, I'm thinking that there's definitely something there, because it's very difficult to have a placebo effect when they're when they're doing it on those folks?
Well, you know, it's just like anything else. If the common paradigm believes that you must keep taking medicine to get better for the rest of your life, that's what you believe. But if the paradigm of other people believe, well, if, you know, the body can heal itself if we give it the right impetus in most instances, it's a different way of thinking. And to, like you're saying, for people to wrap their minds around what a dilution is, I mean, we're talking about serious science. So for the average person just to hear, well, if you dilute something, how could it be stronger? It's really a hard concept to wrap around unless you have some knowledge of science and nuclear science and physics and things like this, right? And so for most patients who are new to homeopathy, it's a process. You know, they might take a remedy and they initially have a first reaction for 2 or 3 days and they feel great, and then all of a sudden they go back to the way they were feeling. Well, it didn't work. Well, no, maybe the dilution was wrong. So then you start telling these people, your patients, put it in more water, dilute it in another cup, 1 cup, 2 cup dilution. At the 3rd cup dilution, wow, there's the difference. And they're smooth sailing, all their symptom picture is better, and they've essentially been cured, quote unquote, right? So this is a difficult concept for people to, because we're so used to being given a prescription, you take this and it goes away.
Right. Sometimes there's no effect of the remedy. Sometimes the patient is better, like they could be improved on all levels, or they can have short improvements, or like you said, briefly worse than improved. Sometimes that's called an aggravation. Sometimes they're worse after the remedy, and sometimes they have a change, but sometimes old symptoms return. Take us through, like, so say you're in the office, right? We only have about 10 more minutes of the show,
okay.
So we have to...
Mm-hmm.
So, say you're in the office and the patient has no effect of the remedy that you gave. What are the things that are going through your mind? It's the wrong remedy, or maybe the wrong potency, or they did something to sort of counteract the medicine?
Usually what's going through my mind is the potency. Because, for me personally, I spend a lot of time analyzing the case, and I have some experience, and I say that because the more experience you have at taking cases is what truly makes you, you know, the homeopath. It's the more cases you take, just like in anything else, the more experienced you are at analyzing and coming up with that single substance. So these days, I'm really thinking it's potency. So I usually stick to my prescription substance, but I'll alter the potency.
Okay. And then someone feels better right away.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes there's an aggravation that happens. What's an aggravation when you're taking a homeopathic remedy?
Right. So when we go back to the action of a homeopathic remedy, which is the insertion of the remedy into the person sublingually, and then the counteraction is the person's physiology or vital force that's responding to the remedy. So sometimes the counteraction, it can take a while for the person to be able to actually counteract. So their body goes through ups and downs or a struggle to rise to what we're trying to heal by putting the remedy and the dilution in. So there's certain individuals that will, like a scale, go up and down and make it worse temporarily, and then maybe a week or two later it lifts and they're better. So the counteraction of the vital force is unpredictable. There's no way to measure it. But we
so
do
you don't
measure
know whether
it.
To tell the patient to... Yeah. I mean, I thought with homeopathy, the less is best. There's like a mantra.
Yes.
Less is like, don't keep taking it if you see changes, because you can actually create some issues, I think, right?
Well, yes, you can start proving it, which goes back to Hahnemann's experiments. in order to elicit symptoms in healthy individuals, he kept giving the remedy daily.
Yes,
so it brought on symptoms. Yes, definitely less is more.
Yeah, less is more. I like that, yeah.
Yes.
And that's what I try to, and that to patients is very difficult because they're used to taking a vitamin every day or echinacea every day or they're taking a mineral every day. It's very different from that. I once the vital force starts working, it's sort of like, I tell patients it's like throwing a big rock in the middle of a lake and watching the waves just propagate out from the side of the lake, like throwing a huge boulder. Eventually the waves may lessen in the amplitude and the patient may need a booster dose of the homeopathic remedy, but generally you just ride the wave. And the other analogy I have patients is I say a disease is like a glass and you're the opera singer and the homeopathic remedy is the opera singer's voice that can shatter the glass by coming up with the resonant frequency. How does that apply to homeopathy, the resonant frequency?
Well, I like that analogy. It has to do with the potency. You know, there's a lot. If people have been chronically ill for a very long time, it's going to take deeper and a little more adjusting of the potency or maybe dosing daily for that vital force to come out of where they've been, you know? And when the vital force finally strengthens or the glass shatters, then it's set free. And the disease process that's been making the vital force of the individual's physiology diseased or heavy opens up. And the person says, oh, wow, I can actually get up today, have energy, feel positive, have less pain in my physical body. And that's how the ripple effect works.
Right.
So then eventually they just begin to be able to cope every day and have a better quality of life.
Now, sometimes old symptoms reoccur when you're giving a remedy, and you have to warn people about that. So tell us a little bit about Herring's Law.
Yeah, so Herring's Law is the law that we follow in homeopathy. It's the law of cure. And it's just directions that we cure, like the ripples, which I like the ripples. So the inner ripples are deeper. They receive the impact of the rock. And then the finer ripples are things maybe unseen that were contributing to the disease of the individual from way back. Diseases maybe when they suffered asthma in their childhood, or they had severe allergies, or other pathogens that they might have encountered that they didn't recover completely from. So when the vital force begins this clearing process, it throws off all the old symptoms that contributed to making it unwell.
Sort of like a reverse timeline in a way, right?
Yes,
wow.
Because the vital force is strengthening and clearing.
Well, we've reached almost the tail end of the show. Now, is homeopathy is very safe, we know, because you're using such dilute but succussed, effective remedies. But
yeah,
it seems to be okay for the elderly and children and people on medications and things like that, but they probably need to see a practitioner. Speaking of which, what's your website, Dr. McPherson, and where could people contact you?
I just opened an office of my own because I had been practicing with two medical doctors for the last 14 years who were lovely in Milford. I'm still in Milford, but I have my practice. My website is drflomcpherson.com.
Is that M-A-C or M-C?
M-C. M-C-P-H-E-R-S-O-N.com.
DrFlomcPherson.com.
Yes.
Well, lastly, tell us a little bit about any research or books that people can read on homeopathy, or what are some good places that you would say, because if you go on the Internet, you're going to read stuff that says it's a bunch of hooey, and then there's some things that are pretty impressive as far as the information goes, or any authors that you find, people that are really interested in homeopathy, want to start reading?
Yes, so I advise people to go on the National Center for Homeopathy website, which has a journal. It has wonderful information about homeopathy. The American Institute of Homeopathy, which has wonderful information and studies, and most of the members of that organization, of which I am a member too, are medical doctors, so you could find a medical doctor that practices homeopathy. And also, the International Academy of Classical Homeopathy, which is Professor George Fethulkes.
Right, now he's supposedly like the luminary. He's like the living legend of homeopathy.
Yes, he is. He wrote a book, The Science of Homeopathy, which is a wonderful book. If you go on the website there, you'll receive much information about his studies and what he has done. He's been practicing a very long time.
Well, homeopathy survived for 250-somewhat years. I think it will survive even more.
Yes,
things like that, if they're total hogwash, are usually extinguished by just the sign of the times. But when I look at ancient medicines that have, and I would say that this is approaching ancient at this point, you know, it's not as ancient as Chinese medicine or acupuncture or Ayurveda, but it's fairly ancient. There's got to be quite a bit to it, or else it would be a fad that would just be a flash in the pan. Any final comments, Dr. McPherson?
I agree with that, and I think that as long as people are continuing to respond to this medicine or this therapy, that is, as my physics teacher used to tell me, the proof is in the pudding.
Yeah, I know. You can't argue with physics. You just have to be open to physics because, you know, like it's funny, I was showing my patient the Tacoma Narrows bridge falling down, and he couldn't believe that that would bend steel. But anyway, we have to go. I hear the music, Dr. McPherson. DrPaulMcPherson.com. Thanks very much for being a guest.
Thank you.
And that does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Take care and stay healthy, everyone. Bye-bye.